This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Good evening and welcome to Africa News Tonight from the English to Africa service of the Voice of America, your source for Pan-African news and world developments. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington.
And I'm Hees Wuhib coming up this hour on Africa News Tonight.
Nigeria's military said on Wednesday that it has rescued one of the 219 schoolgirls abducted by Boko Haram militants from the northeastern town of Chibok over 2 years ago. She is the first girl to be found since the mass kidnapping.
That's Chris Stein with the latest on the rescue. His report coming up next.
Also, Kenyan police face allegations of brutality in connection with Monday's protest in Nairobi. The first Italy-Africa ministerial conference opened today in Rome with over 50 African countries represented. And the Women Deliver conference continues in Copenhagen.
We'll have these stories and lots more ahead on Africa News Tonight.
Our top story this hour, Nigeria's military said today that it has rescued one of the 219 schoolgirls abducted by Boko Haram militants from the northeastern town of Chibok over 2 years ago. She is the first girl to be found since the mass kidnapping. Chris Stein has the latest from Lagos.
The circumstances of the girl's rescue are unclear. Army spokesman Sani Usman said in a text message that the girl was found in the village of Bale, near the northeast Nigerian town of Damboa. A vigilante leader in Chibok, Aboku Gaji, told VOA vigilantes found her while setting up an ambush near a Boko Haram camp.
As we lie ambush, they come just come on us.
Gaji identified the girl as Amina Ali, while the army gave her name as Falmata Balala. Gaji said the rescued girl had a baby with her. She was also with her husband, a fellow Boko Haram captive she had married while in captivity. Gaji said the girl was identified by her mother, then handed over to the military. Boko Haram abducted the 219 schoolgirls in April 2014 from their dormitory at the government secondary school in Chibok. Protesters took to the streets in Nigeria and around the world, imploring the government to bring back our girls. Outside of videos released by the Islamist insurgents, none of the girls had been seen again, until today. The chairman of the Chibok Elders Forum, Pogo Bitris, said he was elated by the rescue.
At least they are alive, they are being found, and whatever situation or condition, that doesn't matter. The important thing is they are alive and they are being found.
Gaji said the rescued girl confirmed what has long been suspected, that Boko Haram was holding the abductees in their stronghold in the Sambisa forest.
She told us that the other girls were still there in the Sambisa.
Gaji said the girl told him six of her abducted classmates had died in captivity. Chris Stein for VOA News, Lagos.
Following the rescue of the 19-year-old kidnapped victim in the Sambisi forest, officials asked her brother to identify her. Reporter Isaac Lyons Abrak in Abuja talked to him by telephone this morning. Abrak told VOA's David Arnold about the scene in Chibok when the Joint Civilian Task Force, who found the girl, met with the brother.
When they approached him, he greeted and exchanged pleasantries with a local vigilante, and they asked him if he knows the girl. He identified her as a sister. They asked Amina if she knows her brother. She identified him as her brother. He now asked her what happened. Amina now told him that yesterday that her camp where the Boko Haram were keeping her was attacked. She fled. So while she was running this morning, she saw some people and she tried to hit into some trees. And those people quickly saw her and they approached her and asked her why she was hiding. And she explained to them that yesterday her camp was attacked and she is running away from the camp. They asked her who she was and she told them that she is one of the Chibok girls who were taken from the school in 2014.
Can you tell me what the mood is in the town of Chibok?
Her brother has described the mood as happy. When she was brought into the town, people were running up and down. Everybody was fleeing to the location where the civilian JTF brought her. Everybody was rushing to that place. So it was like a pandemonium. Generally, the feeling in Chibok is that of joy, is that of happiness. A lot of the parents, especially some that I spoke with, like Esther Yakub, whose daughter Dorcas is amongst the girls that have been taken, she expressed joy. And saying that it gives them a lot of hope that knowing that this girl is amongst their daughters that were taken and that by the grace of God, she would help in finding the remaining girls. So generally, the mood in Chibok is very joyful and very hopeful.
There have been other claims of victims of Boko Haram kidnapping who come forward. This is the first, I understand, that is confirmed.
This is a great development. Over the years, since these girls have been taken, there have always been dialogues from the military, from the government, that these girls were going to be released. There have been situations where women were rescued and they would be confused to be the Chibok girls. You know, recently we had a girl who showed up who was arrested in Cameroon, and she claimed to be one of the Chibok girls. But when officials of the Chibok committee were sent there, they could not identify her as part of the Chibok girls. She's not from Chibok. Hope was almost dying in the hearts of Nigerians. With Amina coming back, being found and returning back to her father's house, and people in Chibok have confirmed that she's actually the missing girl, it gives a lot of hope that these girls are very likely to return back home. Everybody from Chibok, everybody in Nigeria, a lot of people in Nigeria who have been keen about this thing are really having a very positive thought. There is light at the end of the tunnel.
That was reporter Isaac Linus Abrak in Abuja. He spoke with VOA's David Arnold. Also, UN humanitarian chief Stephen O'Brien has reacted to the news of the rescue. He spoke to VOA from the Borno state capital, Maiduguri.
I can tell you that there is enormous quiet excitement here in Nigeria about it, because there is a recognition that this is a wonderful piece of news to have one of the Chibok girls rescued and being returned, because it is at last a sense of confidence of a first step that things can be better and that there is a future and that people can have a sense that the other girls will be found and returned. And let's not forget the other thousands of boys and girls and women who have been abducted. And we know that it's going to be vital that we continue every effort to find all those who have been forced to have to change their lives through no wish of their own because they've been abducted. So here in Maiduguri, which is about 50 kilometres from Chibok, there is a sense of solidarity and a real sense of hope that this is now a step for the future.
That's UN Humanitarian Chief Stephen O'Brien speaking from Maiduguri in northeastern Nigeria.
The first Italy-Africa ministerial conference opened today in Rome. Among those attending are representatives of over 50 African countries, the UN, and high-ranking Italian officials. They include President Sergio Mattarella, who opened the plenary session, and Italy's Minister of Foreign Affairs, Paolo Gentiloni. They're discussing ways of ending the influx of hundreds of thousands of migrants into the European Union each year from Africa, the Middle East, and South Asia. Italy's Prime Minister Matteo Renzi is seeking approval of his migration compact. It aims to provide EU financial incentives to African countries to boost development and deter migration. Reporter Josephine McKenna is in Rome covering the conference. She spoke with me about the significance of the event.
Well, this conference was organized by the Italian Ministry of Foreign Affairs, and it brings together over 40 African ministers from different countries, of course, and the Prime Minister of Italy, Matteo Renzi, plus the President of Italy, Sergio Mattarella. It's a one-day conference. There are also members of the African Union here, and it's designed to discuss opportunities for sustainable growth in Africa, as well as addressing key issues related to immigration and climate change. The Italian Foreign Minister, Paolo Gentiloni, told the conference that it was impossible to exclude the possibility of new migrant emergencies in the future. And the Italian government, of course, is very concerned about the growing number of immigrants who are making the perilous crossing across the Mediterranean. And recently we've seen a surge with the closure of the Balkan route. This year there have been more than 30,000 arrivals from the north coast of Africa across the Mediterranean, landing on the shores of Italy.
Also, he is calling on the AU to make a commitment or a pact with them to prevent Central Mediterranean, that route, from flaring up in the coming months. So what has been the AU's response?
Well, the Italian government put a proposal to the European Union saying that there should be more investment in Africa to encourage those economies, to promote those economies, encourage people to stay at home instead of immigrating to Europe. That requires additional funding from Europe. And at the moment, the EU has given conditional support, but there doesn't seem to be a resolve on how that will be financed. That is something that resonates with the African countries. Today, we saw a presentation from the International Fund for Agricultural Development, the United Nations organization, talking about the importance of rural development and investing in communities, particularly to reduce the impact of climate change and migration.
What do you think the outcome of this conference is going to be at the end of the day?
I think the Italian government wants to promote greater dialogue. There are representatives here from the United Nations and the African Union trying to build relationships, support each other with greater economic investment, and ensure that more people remain in Africa, in North Africa, and have a future of some kind to try and curtail any future wave of immigration that we're likely to see in the coming months across the Mediterranean. That seems like an ambitious goal at the moment because we are seeing a surge of people arriving and growing tension too inside Italy. Yesterday, there was a fire in one of the migrant centres in Lampedusa in Sicily, as there are concerns about overcrowding and where this is going to go in the future if people continue to arrive in Italy.
Can you tell us more about the tension down in Lampedusa and what is being done to try to curb that?
Late Tuesday, a group of migrants set fire to a shelter on the island of Lampedusa. There were no injuries, but it is an indication of the increasing tension in Italy's packed migrant centres. One building was set ablaze, there were no injuries, but this is an indication of just how tense things are. In the past 2 years, more than 320,000 immigrants have arrived by sea on Italian shores, and this year we've had more than 30,000 arrivals. So Italian shelters are bursting at the seams, and there's concern that there won't be enough accommodation if more immigrants continue to arrive.
That was reporter Josephine McKenna speaking with me from the first ever Italy-Africa Ministerial Conference from Rome. You're listening to Africa News Tonight live on the following frequencies, 15, 580 and 6080 kilohertz on the Voice of America. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington.
I'm Yais Wuhib, and at 17 past the hour, here's a recap of our top stories. Nigeria's military said today that it has rescued one of the 219 schoolgirls abducted by Boko Haram militants from the northeastern town of Chibok over 2 years ago. And it's days three of the Woman Delivery Conference in Copenhagen, Denmark. And for more news and information, visit our website at voaafrica.com.
It's day three of the Women Deliver Conference in Copenhagen, Denmark. It's the world's largest gathering devoted to the well-being and empowerment of women and girls. For the third part of our series with headliners at the conference, VOA's Adam Phillips spoke with John Townsend of the Population Council. It's a Washington-based NGO dedicated to women's health. Townsend says women's health has actually improved overall during the past quarter century when world attention began to focus more on women.
In general, I would say women are probably healthier now. There's fewer deaths from pregnancy or delivery complications. There are HIV prevention treatments and care is much more widespread than it was in the early 90s. People are living longer. At the same time, I think women are subject to a diverse set of circumstances. Women who are living in war zones, or women in areas that are affected by drought, women in areas that are affected by infectious diseases. They are the caregivers in the front line for almost all development efforts, making their life more stressful and certainly challenging.
You could have probably said the same thing at any point in time. I mean, is there a worsening that's particular to this historical moment, would you say?
I think in some ways people know about it more. These are public events, not private suffering. We know about sexual and gender-based violence. We know about HIV. I think the difference is people are beginning to say enough.
What are you really excited about in this conference? What do you hope to take away from this personally?
What I'm really excited about is the potential for hope among African youth. We spend a lot of focus on women and girls, but young boys also need opportunities. They will be the partners of those young girls later, and they have to understand, I think, both the benefits and the responsibility that comes with gender equality. Women and girls clearly are at the center. They're also part of families and communities. And so what our role is to create spaces for them where spaces have been denied. Give them the opportunity to ask about accountability of public officials. Women have the right to care, to health. And I think the Women Deliver event is one in which those aspirations will be shared, debated, critiqued, and I would hope implemented.
I'm sure that you butt up against a lot of cultural and also social, not to mention sort of hardwired biological resistance to the idea of limiting the size of your family or planning it too much. I mean, tell me a little bit about how you approach those kind of cultural resistances and encourage people to think in terms of planning, especially girls and women.
I don't want to overstate those obstacles. What we found, I think, in recent years, as we talk to parents about the aspirations for their children, particularly their girls, is that they want the best for them. They want to delay the girls' marriage so they can go to school or they can get a job. Fathers are now carrying girl children for vaccination, where you wouldn't see that a number of years ago. This is a different time. And I think we have to take advantage of that and not be detained by kind of traditional forces, but also that the governments contribute financially to that process. Reproductive health, including family planning and birthing services, was greatly underfinanced for such a long time. And I think we also understand that there's a stream of benefits that go to governments and communities by ensuring that families have the opportunity to remain healthy. They use the health services less. They contribute more on a consistent basis to the economy. They lend their ideas, leadership, their motivation and energy to development. There's a clear expression that investing in these areas will pay off for the economy as well as for the families who no longer will have to bury their wives and children prematurely.
That was John Townsend, Director of Reproductive Health for the Washington, D.C.-based Population Council and one of those attending the Women Deliver Conference in Copenhagen. He spoke with VOA's Adam Phillips.
Not all countries are affected equally when it comes to climate change. In fact, scientists say rich nations probably will fare better than poor nations in some ways, and it's not just about the money. VOA's Jody Capua reports.
In climate change, as in business, it's location, location, location. And some very poor nations apparently are at the wrong latitudes when it comes to the impact of rising global temperatures. A team of international researchers says those countries are likely to experience heat extremes sooner than wealthy nations. Dr. Manoj Joshi is a senior lecturer at the University of East Anglia's School of Environmental Sciences in Britain.
There's an emerging field people have started looking at in the last few years related to climate change, which is called times of emergence. And it's not how much the world warms, but how fast it warms and how much that warming is related to the natural variation in climate from year to year.
He says the location of many wealthy nations allows greater variability in temperatures from year to year because they're not tropical countries. They're located in what are called the extratropics. In a sense, more natural variability in their weather offers some protection from heat extremes.
The extratropics, where a lot of the richest countries of the world lie, the climate signal is large, but the variability, what we call the year-to-year variation, is also large. So paradoxically, a lot of countries in the tropics, even though they warm more slowly, they will get more significant temperature rises quicker.
Joshi says if daily temperatures remain fairly steady in tropical countries From day to day and then year to year, people do not learn to adapt to extremes.
So if the variation is low, then any sort of change on top of that will be an extreme event because you're adapted to less variability.
He says countries in the Horn of Africa and West Africa are likely to be among the worst affected by heat extremes.
We're talking about tropical countries, those nearer the equator. And what it means is these countries will experience extreme temperatures earlier than we'll experience extreme temperatures, sooner than we will, at a lower level of carbon dioxide, at a lower level of what's called in this paper cumulative emissions, when we add up the total amount of CO2 that all of us are putting into the atmosphere.
And ironically, poor countries, expected to see heat extremes sooner than rich nations, actually produce much less carbon dioxide emissions.
Yeah, that's certainly very interesting. It's just a way of how the climate system plays out, essentially. It's a consequence of that. The climate system responds in terms of the laws of physics. So it's not a question of fair or unfair. It's what the climate system is doing.
Drought is plaguing regions of the Horn of Africa, creating insecurity for many thousands of people. But Joshi says you have to be careful connecting that directly to climate change.
There's a drought going on in parts of the Horn of Africa, but some of that could be related to anomalous temperatures in the Indian Ocean or the El Nino that's been going on for the past 6 months to a year. So we have to be very careful attributing specific events to climate change rather than variability. But the sorts of extreme temperatures that we're talking about, they might start happening sooner in these sorts of countries.
Researchers say it's not clear whether efforts to limit CO2 emissions during the rest of this century will do anything to lessen the impact on poor countries. But they say the information may be used to help countries adapt to climate change. The findings are published in Environmental Research Letters. Joe DiCapua, VOA News, Washington.
And that wraps up this edition of Africa News Tonight. Stay tuned for Straight Talk Africa with Shaka Sali, coming up at 18:30 UTC. I'm Yehiyi Suhib in Washington.
And I'm Kim Lewis. And for all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at voaafrica.com. On behalf of our producer, Bill Workinger, and our engineer, Misha Dubinsky, thanks for choosing the Voice of America.
Next time on Straight Talk Africa, we'll discuss whether there's a need for a fundamental change in U.S.-Africa relations. Join host Shaka Sali and his guests as they discuss U.S.-Africa relations next Wednesday at 18:30 UTC, right here on VOA Africa.
Feast with your ears on Music Time in Africa, your connection to the best Pan-African music. Hello, this is Heather Maxwell inviting you to join me every Saturday and Sunday at 1500 and 2000 UTC. Every show brings you the best music from across the continent. Old songs you know and love, and new songs to discover. You'll meet artists too. Listen to Africa's superstars and rising stars in exclusive, unplugged interviews on the radio or on my YouTube channel. Search for Heather Maxwell, Music Time in Africa. We play only the best right here on VOA Africa.
Hello, Africa. This is James Butte, host of Voice of America's Daybreak Africa. Join me Monday through Friday at 3, 4, 5, and 6 hours UTC for the latest in Africa news, features, and sports. We are also available on the internet at www.africanews.org. voaafrica.com. That's Daybreak Africa, your breakfast show on the Voice of America.
voaafrica.com.
On voaafrica.com, the news updates never stop. Our primary goal is to keep you informed.
voaafrica.com, your trusted source for news and information.